to me, the biggest story of the week, the one that I'm most excited about, is our next story. Joining us right now, Vladimir Arapetian. He is an astrophysicist, a solar physicist, an astrobiologist. He is at NASA Goddard. Dr. Arapetian, thank you so much for joining us. Do I have to call you doctor?
Yep.
doctor. This is very exciting. Seven Earth-sized planets were discovered on a dwarf star. How far away is this dwarf star? I thought 5 light years, is that accurate?
40.
40 light years. So it's not like we're going there tomorrow.
Yeah, I want to tell you a little bit about this discovery. This is an incredible discovery because it challenges our understanding of how Earth-like planets may form around low-mass stars. And the planetary worlds around TRAPPIST-1, this is the name of the star, should be very exotic and very different from our own. So just it's incredible that before 1995, we didn't even realize that we have so many strange worlds around us. And now we have discovered over 3,500 exoplanets and with 2,000 planetary systems.
We couldn't even tell there were exoplanets until very recently.
Right, yeah. So all we knew about like 8 planets in our solar system.
Right.
So I want to talk a little bit about this strange system. So let me introduce me the star of the show, TRAPPIST-1 and 7 dwarfs. Because
it is a red dwarf. That is not like the sun, right?
Well, it is much, much cooler. I call it a cool star, actually. It's a cool mother star and 7 dwarfs. So it's twice cooler than our sun. It's a little bit less than 3,000 kelvins surface temperature. So, and it's 10 times smaller. It's a little bit larger than Jupiter, okay? It's really, really a small star.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes, and because it's so cool and small, it's pretty dim. It's about 2,000 times dimmer than our sun. However, it is a very magnetically active star. It has a very strong magnetic field, and this star flares. And it flares pretty frequently. And that's because this star is a young star. It's only 440 million years old star. And so in perspective of human life, I would say it's only 5 years old. Okay, so because it's expected to live for like another 10 billion years. And imagine that you have a young star and seven dwarfs around this star. The conditions that those exoplanets experience are pretty exotic, because imagine that you take our Earth and move 100 times closer to our sun that we are right now, okay? 100 times close. So we will be grilled. But because the star is so cool and dim, so imagine or not, the conditions are habitable.
But you call planets, or I've heard planets that are Earth-like could support Earth-like life, Goldilocks planets, because they're in the Goldilocks zone.
Well, and liquid water can, yeah.
They got water, they got the temperatures are within a reasonable range.
Right.
There are Goldilocks planets in this system.
Yes, yes. So we have discovered number of Goldilocks planets, and in principle, if the conditions are mild, I'm talking about, you know, ionizing radiation from the star, then the conditions are could be favorable for life, because water is such an important ingredient of life. It's the major solvent of life. So we need water in order to dissolve molecules of life and create more complex biological molecules. However, imagine that if you place a planet pretty close to its host star, then the X-ray emission, UV emission can really be detrimental for the life forms. So that's why it is so important to understand each system, each star, you know, separately in case-by-case study. So I am really, really excited about this system because we have a good laboratory, and this system is pretty close. We have an upcoming mission in the James Webb Space Telescope that will be launched in November next year. And this telescope will present an absolutely incredible opportunity to observe this closed world. And so the Proxima B, that was another, you probably heard about this discovery, that was an exoplanet that was recently detected around the Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star to us. This is a little bit farther away, but still pretty close to us to be observed by a powerful telescope like James Webb Space Telescope. So that's why I would say that we live in a golden era of the space exploration, and I'm really excited that in a few years we will have much better understanding of the nature of this world, and understand through the eyes of those exoplanets to understand the life on our own planet.
Yes, I understand when James Webb actually gets up and operational, then it will be able to search for signs of oxygen, methane, and ozone. Is it in these seven planets?
Well, yes. If you're lucky enough, if the atmosphere is thick enough, yes, definitely we will try to look for signatures of life. And because the nitrogen, for instance, this is the one important ingredient of life. So no wonder that we have 77% of molecular nitrogen in the Earth atmosphere. It's not a cosmic coincidence. It's a requirement for life. And then we have another thing. Another gas is an oxygen, which is the a product of photosynthesis. So and then methane. It's the product of the decay. So those gases trace life. They're not life by itself, by definition, but they trace life. And of course, we're not going to see those little green men, but we will be able to know whether conditions experienced, you know, here on Earth are typical. Because we want to know whether our planet is typical, whether our planetary system, solar system, is typical. And I would imagine in the next 10, 20 years, we will have definitely much more exact answers to those questions.
I guess one of the questions, one of the cosmic questions humans have asked is, are we alone in the universe? So that's one question that will maybe not be answered, but we'll have some evidence that maybe we're not unique. Maybe our planet is not unique.
I think it was Arthur C. Clarke who said that there are two possibilities. Either we are alone or we aren't alone, and both of those are terrifying.
I know. But I also would guess that can we learn something about ourselves from what we learn from these planets?
Absolutely. So this, this 3,000, over 3,500 discovered planets provide a unique opportunity to look for signatures of life and to understand our place in the universe. Because the question of are we alone suggests that we want to understand that whether even microbial life, that now we understand that the microbial life should be pretty typical, should be pretty widespread, across the universe, across our galaxy, for instance. So now that we understand, we now, since 1953 and the experiments of Mir and Euler and Urey, when the first amino acids was synthesized, in the laboratory, now our group, together with in Japan, so I have collaborators at the Tokyo Institute of Technology, we're trying now to reproduce nuclear basis, the building blocks of RNA molecule from those,
wow.
From the gases of that we believe were major constituents of the early Earth.
So you're trying to answer one of the most fundamental questions, which is how did life arise from this chemical stew And if you can simulate that, that is just yet another piece in this mystery.
Mm-hmm. Although there is always the possibility that it came in, you know, hitched a ride on a meteorite and came in.
But it had to arise somewhere, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly right. So that the group that I'm heading now, it's called Mission to Young Earth 2.0. And the major goal of this group is to find another planet pregnant with life.
Wow.
So we're trying to find a planet in the, you know, making life. So because one thing that we have a theory, another thing, we reproduce this, we calibrate this theory, validate the theory in the lab, and the ultimate goal is to find it. To find it, a planet, you know, around young sun, resembling our sun 3.8 billion years ago. And now that we know what kind of molecules to look for, we will look for the major, you know, simplest ingredients that are going to make complex sugars and eventually building blocks of RNA and DNA molecule.
Oh, so, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'm really very excited about it. And I would tell you that by the end of this year, we will have results of our experiments. We have our first paper about the first production of amino acids from bare chemical elements like molecular nitrogen,
fantastic,
carbon dioxide, methane, and a little bit of water vapor.
Throw them in a box, shake them up, and life emerges? I mean, it's got to have some conditions. Well, must be very specific, yeah?
Well, one thing that I'm learning and understanding now, that in order to see that if you throw these molecules and wait, then nothing will happen. And that's why from that standpoint, only miracle can make.
Right.
However, if you throw this molecule and supply some energy, and make this energy, you know, like lightning or energetic particles, like in our model, energetic protons from the young sun, then those energetic particles, they dissociate those molecules, they create simpler pieces, and those simple pieces suddenly becomes reactive. They start to create new pieces of new molecules that are much more reactive than the original molecules, the inert molecules like molecular nitrogen. So and then you add them to the to water and irradiate with the protons, you get, you know, nuclear bases. So life needs a lot of energy. So I say that you know, water is cheap, but life is expensive. It is energetically expensive.
It is amazing. And I remember talking to scientists in the early 90s saying, well, you know, there might be other planets out there, but we have never observed that. Now we know, not only do we know there are other planets out there, but there are Earth-like planets out there, and there are thousands of them. And now you're attempting to demonstrate in this experiment in Japan that it might not even be very far-fetched that the particular conditions for life to emerge might actually be common enough. It sounds like you can't prove this, but it sounds like, given the billions and billions of stars and billions of galaxies, that the likelihood is, we've seen so many planets already, that there is life out there. That this is it. You can't prove it, but it seems highly likely. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, it seems highly likely. And the astrobiologists, our community, astrobiological community, are pretty optimistic that a life should be a mandatory state of matter.
Wow.
Even I would
that would put some.
So not merely exist by chance, but actually.
Right.
Everywhere,
given the circumstances, you need to have, you know, certain bare gases. Mm-hmm. You need to have energy. I would compare it like, you know, when I'm trying to explain what life needs, I say, what do you need in order to make a cookie?
Right.
You know, life cookies, let's say. So you need,
chocolate chips, flour, butter, and an oven.
Yeah, right. And then oven, that's your energy.
The sun, yeah.
That's supplies by the sun, exactly. You need the dough and water. That's all. Three ingredients. I mean, generally, and given the chance, but you need to apply this oven, you know, you need to keep this dough, you know, in the oven for about 100 million years. And this kind of so-called, it's not a miracle anymore then. It's just a mandatory requirement because you keep trying to keep producing pieces and you help the complexity to go on and on and on, producing the up to some point. It's like, you know, you have a small wave, you know, ripples on the water, right? So you add more energy, you increase the amplitude of it, and eventually you create a tsunami. You create a rogue wave. And imagine at some level, the rogue wave, it's a structure that doesn't need any additional conditions to function. It will now, you know, interact with rogue waves like its own. That's what life is. It will forget about its dark past, about its, you know, the primitive conditions. It will live and it will interact and will reproduce and will follow Darwinian evolution.
And of course, once you have reproduction, the rest follows.
Right.
So,
right.
Until the sun gets nasty again and fries the
entire
planet.
Now, what about? So then we've got all of the pieces for Fermi's paradox, because we can posit that life is commonplace, must be commonplace. So where are they? Why haven't we met them?
That's another question. When I talk about life, I imply microbial life.
It's not civilization, I understand.
No. But look, life on Earth started 3.8 billion years ago.
Right. Takes a while.
And it existed for a couple of billions of years at least 1.5 billion years as a single cell organism.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's only later it started to become more complex, multicellular organism eventually. Yeah. And look, the human life is not a necessary, I would say, form of life. For instance, before
sagebrush. That's pretty complex.
Before the disappearance of dinosaurs 65 years ago,
yeah.
You know, we didn't have a niche, for life.
Right.
Dinosaurs occupied all possible niches, and it was a cosmic coincidence that they were killed. And
right.
they opened mm-hmm. up a new avenue right. for us.
No asteroid, that's... no mammals,
yep.
no mammals, yeah. no space travel.
Yeah, so therefore, us, and there is a big gap in terms of the evolution
right.
from single-celled organisms
right.
to us.
Right.
So that might resolve the Fermi's paradox that we, you have to also keep in mind that to produce humans, we are very, very vulnerable to the to external conditions, to stellar catastrophes.
Right.
Imagine that you have a supernova explosion and the star is not that far away; it can kill life.
Right.
The sum of the calculations show that you can really reduce the amount of ozone, the atmosphere by like 70% for many months, letting the ionizing radiation pass through the atmosphere. So a lot of things can go on, and so if you take that in the perspective of life on other planets, I'm pretty optimistic that we can find it, but it will take some time. However, microbial life will be much more easier to spot.
Okay.
And we definitely should go for it.